on this edition for Sunday, June 21st.
You are warriors. Thank you.
President Trump returns to the re-election campaign trail. COVID-19 cases continue to surge across the country, and anti-Asian discrimination worries as schools weigh reopening in the fall. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
When it comes to wireless, Consumer Cellular gives its customers the choice. Our no-contract plans give you as much or as little talk, text, and data as you want. And our U.S.-based customer service team is on hand to help. To learn more, go to consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. President Donald Trump restarted his on-the-road re-election campaign last night to a less-than-full arena in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Mr. Trump gave a sprawling 1 hour and 41-minute speech at his first rally in more than 3 months. He used a racist term to describe the COVID-19 virus and repeated the false claim that increased testing is responsible for the large number of COVID-19 cases in the U.S.
When you do testing to that extent, you're going to find more people. You're going to find more cases. So I said to my people, slow the testing down, please.
A White House official said today that the president was being, quote, tongue-in-cheek about testing being slowed. We'll have more on increases in COVID-19 infections in many parts of the country in our news summary. Despite promises by the Trump campaign of record crowds, by the time the president took the stage last night at the 19,000-seat BOK Arena, thousands of seats were empty. Outside, a stage set up for overflow attendees was dismantled before the president arrived in Tulsa. Before entering the arena, teams of people took the temperatures of Trump supporters, but there was no requirement that people wear masks, and many did not. Attendees also agreed to a waiver not to hold the campaign liable if they get sick.
No justice, no peace!
Near the arena, largely peaceful protesters blocked some streets. During the evening, there were also small pro-Trump protests. And in other parts of Tulsa, Black Lives Matter demonstrations had a festive feel as protesters continued celebrating Juneteenth. While the president was traveling to Oklahoma, Jeffrey Berman made it official that he was no longer the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. After a day-long standoff with Attorney General William Barr, the president fired Berman, who then agreed to step down last night, with his deputy being named interim U.S. attorney. In an interview today, House Judiciary Chairman Gerald Nadler said Berman had been invited to testify before his committee as he investigates political interference in the Justice Department. But Nadler also said that calls for the impeachment of Attorney General Barr didn't make sense right now.
They are a waste of time at this point because we know that we have a corrupt Republican majority in the Senate, which will not consider an impeachment no matter what the evidence and no matter what the facts.
For more on the many issues, controversies, and what's ahead in national politics, NewsHour Weekend special correspondent Jeff Greenfield joins us now from Santa Barbara, California. Jeff, let's start with what turned out to be a very strange matchup, which was Attorney General Barr versus USA Berman. We had trouble following this yesterday on all the different contours that they were taking, but what's the impact here?
Well, just to review the bidding, Friday night late, Attorney General Barr says U.S. Attorney Berman is going to step down, and I'm going to replace him with a guy who's a very loyal ally of Trump. 2 hours later, Berman says, I didn't resign. So the next day, Barr says, okay, I talked to the president. He says, you're fired. Then the president tells the press, I had nothing to do with this. And by the end of this bizarre 24 hours, Berman is stepping down to be replaced by his deputy, who is not a political ally of Trump, or just a prosecutor. And the impact is a lot of what the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York was doing was not pleasing to the president, either investigating his inaugural committee for the misuse of funds, Deutsche Bank, which was a big creditor of Trump's, Giuliani and his law firm. So That's part of why this got eyebrows raised. But then there's the part about John Bolton. Friday night, ABC News released the transcript in clip of the interview where Bolton, former national security advisor, written a very critical book of Trump, said the president told the president of Turkey he was going to intervene with the U.S. Attorney's Office to protect the State Bank of Turkey. That's why this has raised so many eyebrows over the last 48 hours.
Let's talk about the rally in Tulsa yesterday. There was a lot of concern that during a pandemic, this wasn't the best idea. The end result?
Well, to put it in a technical political science term, not good. Dr. Fauci, the public health officials in Tulsa were all saying the worst thing you can do is pack people into a crowded room where they're making a lot of noise because that'll spread the particles. But what basically happened was that the Trump campaign was telling us this was going to be a huge event. They had gotten a million requests for tickets. And when the time came for the rally, it turned out that nobody showed up for that overflow crowd. And the hall was perhaps half full. What makes this really intriguing is there is a group of people who participate on social media apps like TikTok and K-pop, the Korean music, organized some kind of guerrilla operation to ask for an enormous number of tickets. The point being to inflate the estimates and to deluge the Trump campaign with useless data. The whole point about getting these rallies is to get voter data. And you have to remember that this president particularly obsesses with the size of his crowds. You remember back in the inaugural, how angry he got when Obama had outdrawn him. So the pictures of the half-empty hall and the stories of sputtering event is exactly what you don't want to kick off a campaign. Even though crowd sizes don't tell you much about votes, I mean, Bernie Sanders got huge crowds, Joe Biden couldn't fill a telephone booth. But it's really important for the, as they say, the optics, because the press put so much attention on it. This was not the way you want to start a campaign.
Now, you watched the entire speech. Was there any inkling of a strategy of how this campaign is going to play out?
Yes, it's very clear, and it has been for a while, that the president is not pursuing any kind of unity or reconciliation message. There was no mention of Juneteenth, Black Emancipation Day. There was no mention of George Floyd. It was all about how the radicals and Antifa are going to burn your cities down. They're going to abolish the police. Joe Biden is a pawn of the radicals. So it's pretty clear that they are pursuing a base strategy to gin up his core supporters in enough numbers that they can outdo the loss he has in places like the suburbs.
Looking back at the week, which seems so long ago now, there were some big Supreme Court decisions that were not in favor of the administration. But you point out that decisions are decisions, and they can go work against you in the future.
Yeah, there were two celebrations on the part of what we'll broadly call liberals. So one, the Title VII, the civil rights law, protects not just sex, but sexual orientation. You can't fire somebody because they're gay. And also the deferred action on childhood arrivals. The court said that Trump could not end it the way he did. But if you're going to read Title VII literally, the way Justice Gorsuch, the key vote, did, you can also see that he would be very skeptical about affirmative action. You can't hire somebody just because they're Black because you want to increase numbers. If he reads the statute that literally, that's trouble. And as far as DACA goes, what the court said was, yeah, the president can abolish it by executive order. He just didn't do it the right way. So I think those who are celebrating these decisions may want to take a deep breath and see what the long-term consequences might be.
Jeff Greenfield, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
For more national and international news, visit pbs.org/newshour. New cases of the coronavirus are increasing in states across the South, West, and Midwest, with seven states hitting single-day record highs yesterday. Nationwide, there were more than 30,000 new infections on both Friday and Saturday, the highest total since May 1st. Southern states are seeing some of the highest spikes. Florida, Alabama, South Carolina, Louisiana, and Mississippi are all in the top 10 for the largest number of new cases per capita over the past 2 weeks. In the same time period, overall virus-related deaths are dropping, with the 14-day average down 42% as of yesterday. According to Johns Hopkins University, COVID-19 has infected 2.2 million people in the United States, and nearly 120,000 people have died from the virus. Minnesota legislators could not agree to police reform after a week of negotiations and intense hearings during a special session. George Floyd's death last month while in Minneapolis police custody and all the protests that followed compelled the legislature to address new police accountability measures. But Democrats lead the state's House and Republicans the state's Senate. House Democrats charge that the Republican Senate reform proposal, which includes requiring police officers to step in if they see other officers using excessive force, did not go far enough. Republicans argued that the House measures, such as putting the state's attorney general in charge of prosecuting police killings, was too far. A subsequent House countermeasure eliminated this requirement. Yesterday afternoon, Governor Tim Walz, a Democrat, said the legislature's failure to pass a bill was an embarrassment for the state. A deadly shooting in Minneapolis early this morning left one man dead and 11 people with non-life-threatening injuries, according to police. The shooting took place in uptown Minneapolis, a commercial district with several restaurants and bars. The area is about 3 miles west of the location where George Floyd, a black man, died while in police custody last month. Officials said there was no connection between recent anti-racism protests and last night's shooting. Police said they believe there may have been more than one shooter. As of noon today, they were still searching for the suspects who were described only as, quote, individuals on foot. In the United Kingdom, police are calling a stabbing rampage that killed 3 people and wounded 3 others yesterday a terrorist act. The victims were sitting in a park in Reading, west of London, when they were attacked by a 25-year-old man who police believe acted alone. Unarmed officers arrested the suspect at the scene. Britain's press association identified him as a Libyan citizen seeking asylum who was living in Reading. Police say they do not believe there is any further danger to the public, and Britain's terrorism threat level has not been raised. China's top government lawmaking committee announced today that it will meet again at the end of this month, raising concerns for Hong Kong's autonomy. Beijing is considering enacting a law that would set up an office in Hong Kong to collect intelligence and handle criminal cases related to national security. Today's announcement did not mention that the security law will be on the agenda, but the possibility stoked fears that Beijing is planning to tighten its grip on the semi-autonomous territory. The timing comes right before a July 1st holiday that marks Hong Kong's return to China. Since the coronavirus pandemic hit, there have been increasing reports of anti-Asian discrimination, including in schools. Last month, the New York City Commission on Human Rights launched a 2-month campaign aimed at educating the public on racism. But as schools weigh whether or not to open their doors in the fall, parents of Asian American children say they fear that school might not be a safe place when it reopens. NewsHour Weekend special correspondent Simon Ostrowski has our report.
For every parent, their child's safety is the number one priority. And every mom and dad is wondering what precautions are going to be put in place when schools eventually reopen. But for parents of Asian children, there's another worry on top of everything else.
In the weeks and months that preceded school closures and stay-at-home orders, there was a spike of an epidemic of a different kind in classrooms around the country.
The latest target, a young boy from the San Fernando Valley.
A young person was bullied in his middle school, physically attacked, and accused of having the coronavirus simply because he was Asian American.
Racially motivated harassment against Asian pupils, ranging from teasing to physical attacks. Their classmates blaming them for the spread of coronavirus, based solely on their appearance. Now, Asian American parents are asking how their children can safely go back to class next fall.
I'm not confident that the DOE is going to create a safe environment for children of color, particularly Asian children at this time.
In April, the FBI warned it was concerned about the potential for hate crimes around the country against minorities perceived to be responsible for the spread of the virus. America's largest school district, New York City, which carefully tracks instances of bullying, said there was an increase in the weeks leading up to the lockdown. But Deputy Chancellor Adrian Austin refused to divulge to NewsHour Weekend the specific numbers of bias-based bullying incidents.
We saw a trend prior to going to remote learning. We were seeing a trend of bias-based instances against our Asian communities.
Jaime Huynh is a 16-year-old high school student in the Bronx, New York. She told NewsHour Weekend she struggled to get administrators to react after a fellow classmate lashed out at her with a virus-related insult when she refused to let the student copy her completed homework assignment.
I just chose not to give it to him because I worked really hard on it. And so he said, oh, that's why you have corona. And then people just around me just start laughing. And I just felt really like, I didn't know what to do.
This incident might not sound terribly serious taken on its own. But for Jaime, it came after weeks of overhearing chatter in the school corridors about Asians eating bats and rats and being, quote, dirty.
The incidents really vary depending on age level and severity. Sometimes it could be a child just repeating words that they've heard, you know, and then others may be more deliberate, which could escalate to things that may be considered a hate crime. So it runs the gamut.
In New York as a whole, the Human Rights Commission recorded 145 complaints of anti-Asian bias and harassment since February, compared to just 11 for the same period last year. Not all rose to the level of a hate crime, but among the 18 that did, a disturbing trend.
What stood out to us was that of the perpetrators, more than one-third are teenagers. And so that's why we really want to reach them.
With attacks against Asians so widespread among minors, New York's Office of Hate Crime Prevention urged the city's Department of Education to put together a how-to guide for dealing with incidences of biased bullying before school doors swung back open. Here's the office's expert on education, Daria Weissman, describing the project to an Asian American advocacy group in a conference call in May.
Early in the outbreak, we had first in the office started hearing stories of COVID-related bias and hate crimes. We wanted to put something together, a list of resources for educators so they could actually speak to their students to address and also to anticipate problems, thinking about when students re-enter the physical classroom.
The guide, which is downloadable from the New York City Hall website and is available to educators everywhere, points teachers to resources like this article, describing how a Chinese doctor pioneered an early medical mask or practical advice on countering extremism online.
What we're seeing right now is definitely not unique to New York City, although that being said, it's happening in cities in which there's a significant Asian population. So New York, San Francisco Bay Area, and Los Angeles would be the three probably the most prominent.
Experts and educators say social media and comments overheard from parents help fuel narratives about who's to blame for the virus. They also say language used by the president early on in the crisis didn't help either.
I talk about the Chinese virus, and I mean it. That's where it came from.
So how concerned should parents be about schoolyard teasing that targets children's identities?
This is life or death. I mean, for students who internalize bullying, who internalize discrimination, we see an increase in the number of suicides amongst kids. And on the other hand, for kids who go unaddressed, where this hatred goes unaddressed and it festers, we see instances where adults take the lives of other people based on discrimination.
One brutal incident that is being addressed is the March 28th attack on a 51-year-old Asian woman on a Bronx bus, in which several teenage girls accused her of spreading the virus.
They ended up attacking her, and she had to get stitches on her head.
Elizabeth O. Young runs a program for New York youth that aims to resolve hate crimes through out-of-court mediation instead of relying on the criminal justice system alone. She told NewsHour Weekend the perpetrators of the bus attack would be able to avoid a criminal record by participating in her 10-week anti-bias educational program.
What do you say to people who say this is just a slap on the wrist for violent perpetrators with a hateful mindset?
If you bring a complaint, the first time these young offenders are not likely to get much of a punishment, in fact, a slap on the wrist. The victim, who is a 51-year-old woman, is so supportive of the youth participating in this program. She wants assurance that they're not going to do this again, that they understand why it was wrong. And that's what I think our project will definitely accomplish.
Parents like Yuli Xu hope that whenever school doors open again, her children and others will be entering a safe space.
My first distinct experience was when I was five in our suburban Ohio neighborhood, and other children throwing verbal slurs, racial slurs at me, as well as rocks in my face. Yeah, so these are definitely things I would hope my children never experience.
In recent weeks, college and professional sports teams have started to declare Election Day a holiday for employees and players. So far, the Memphis Grizzlies, the Minnesota Timberwolves, and Lynx, the NCAA, and others have jumped on board. To learn more about this movement, NewsHour Weekend's Megan Thompson spoke to Wall Street Journal sports reporter Louise Rednovsky, who's been covering the story.
So what motivated this?
You know, I think what's been striking in the last couple of weeks is the number of athletes, many of whom had previously branded themselves as apolitical or just not that kind of outspoken athlete, who've come forward and stepped out and said that they support Black Lives Matter, which, you know, as a movement was considered to be somewhat radical or controversial in some cases for athletes until recently, at which point things have flipped around a little bit, and athletes who have not said that they support the movement have come under criticism for that. So there's been this huge change in athletes' approach to activism, particularly among, I think, strikingly white and other non-Black athletes. And you've seen organizations not only rush to embrace their athletes, but also rush to embrace this movement, in some cases reversing previous stances that they had had on sending political messages or allowing their athletes to protest. So you're really seeing a sort of a repositioning of all of these brands, the individual brands and the team brands, and at the same time, they're under pressure to deliver on what that actually means in practice. So I think what you're seeing in Election Day is the first tangible policy change coming from any organization that has aligned itself with Black Lives Matter.
It seems like it is a positive step for these teams to be doing this. But like you mentioned, a lot of the teams and the players have been kind of wary of wading into some of these issues in the past. Is this kind of an easy way to check the box right now in terms of being able to say that they've done something? Are there other things that teams are under pressure to do?
I think it's certainly an easier way for a team to do something that is generally considered to be more politically palatable, right? Everybody thinks that voting generally is a good thing, and increasing voter turnout is a good thing. So it's a relatively non-controversial way of making a change. Of course, what you're hearing from Black Lives Matter in some parts of the country is a far more demanding demand, if you will. You're not hearing a lot of teams right now rushing to say that they have a position on whether to defund the police, for example. But saying where you stand on Election Day might be a first step to that. It might be the final step. I think that's what we're going to be watching really closely.
So this isn't a new idea, right? I mean, where else have we seen efforts like this in this country?
It's not a new idea. You've seen 13 states already make Election Day a holiday, and a 14th, Virginia, joined them this year, although in some states those bills failed. And Congress has also been under pressure to consider this. It was supported by a number of Democrats. It was somewhat resisted in the Republican-controlled Senate. But Congress's failure to take a federal position on this, for example, created an opening for teams to go in there and make policy themselves. And they're hoping that other companies might follow suit as well.
When people are given the day off on Election Day, does it actually boost voter turnout?
From a paper about 10 years ago, what we've seen is that making Election Day a paid holiday doesn't on its own increase voter turnout. I think what you're seeing with players in particular is almost an attempt to create a new experiment. What would Election Day look like if you had a paid day off and you had a paid day off for very high profile figures seeking to go ahead and get out the vote themselves?
All right, Louise Rednovsky of the Wall Street Journal, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you so much.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Stay healthy. Happy Father's Day. Thanks for watching and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.